It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
UN Security Council set to approve new peacekeeping mission to Central African Republic. Italy overwhelmed by an influx of African migrants. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The UN Security Council is set to authorize a new expanded peacekeeping force for the Central African Republic today. The council is expected to adopt a resolution calling for a force of some 10,000 soldiers and 1,800 police to help restore order. Speaking Wednesday in Bangui, U.S.-UN Ambassador Samantha Powers said more international support is urgently needed for that security operation.
There's no question that we need to redouble our efforts. We're making them every day anyway. But this adds even more urgency to the task of getting more troops and more police deployed rapidly in order to fill those gaps, which really do exist.
According to a draft resolution seen by VOA, the U.N. force will be operational by mid-September. When it will take over from the existing African force in CAR, some 6,000 African troops and 2,000 French troops have been unable to contain sectarian violence that's killed thousands. On Wednesday, local authorities and witnesses told VOA at least 30 people were killed when anti-Balaka militants launched an attack in the central town of Dakoa. A UN report released Wednesday said more than 3,600 women, children, and men were subjected to rape and other sexual violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The violence documented covered a period from January 2010 to December of last year. UN Rights Chief Navi Pillay, while hailing progress in the area of military justice for sexual crimes, warned there is still a long way to go, adding that the political will is not sufficiently translated on the ground. Italy says it's rescued some 4,000 migrants from the Mediterranean Sea over the past 2 days. Interior Minister Angelino Alfano said migrant rescues and landings have been nonstop and getting worse. He's demanding the European Union do more to help police Mediterranean waters, saying tens of millions of dollars have failed to solve the problem. Somali officials meeting this week in the United Arab Emirates report a growing optimism about the prospects for stability despite years of piracy, poverty, and terrorism. Philip Walter Wellman reports they hope to begin to attract foreign investment to Somalia.
Participants at the Somali Investment Summit in Dubai painted a different picture of the East African country than the one the world has become familiar with.
If in past years the image was hunger, piracy, terrorism, today if you will see a different scenario, you will see a light at the end of the tunnel, you will see hope. And that life is coming back.
That was Ali Mohamed Gedi, the former prime minister of Somalia's transitional federal government. Growing stability in Somalia, which is grappling with a two-decade-old civil war, can largely be attributed to outside intervention. Over the past year, African Union troops helped drive al-Shabaab militants from major cities, and out at sea, international naval patrols led to a significant decrease in pirate attacks. But Getty warns that the outcome of these efforts could be short-lived unless more is done to address the underlying problem of poverty among the Somali population. While conditions in Somalia have been improving, they're by no means ideal for investors. In addition to safety threats and the lack of a central government, corruption is rife, and there's an absence of a skilled workforce. This is Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is to meet today in Washington with South Sudan's minister in the office of the president, Awan Riak, amid ongoing conflict. Spokesperson Jen Psaki Wednesday outlined Mr. Kerry's message.
Secretary Kerry will emphasize the importance of ending the fighting, implementing the cessation of hostilities agreement, resolving outstanding issues through an inclusive national dialogue, ensuring humanitarian and UN access, and putting a stop to human rights abuses.
She says while no South Sudanese officials or entities have been targeted yet for sanctions, they could be imposed if they are seen as obstructing the peace and reconciliation process. Meanwhile, the charity group Doctors Without Borders has lashed out at the UN mission in South Sudan, saying it's refusing to move thousands of displaced South Sudanese to safer grounds ahead of the rainy season, calling it a shocking display of indifference. The world body hit back, spokesperson Stefan Dujarric saying the UN is doing its best to decongest the Tomping camp near the Juba airport. Sudan has expelled American UN chief Pamela DeLarge, accusing her of interfering in domestic affairs. The foreign ministry says Ms. DeLarge, in the country since 2010, was not abiding by national laws. It's just the latest incident involving foreign aid workers following the suspension in February of Red Cross work in Sudan. Aid worker movements have been restricted in the war zones of South Kordofan and Blue Nile states. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. More can be found at our internet website, voanews.com.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United States expresses thanks and support for peacekeepers in the Central African Republic.
It would be far worse if not for your efforts to protect civilians, disarm militia, and create areas where families can be safe. I commend you on behalf of President Obama and the United States.
Samantha Powell is the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry meets today in Washington with the representatives of South Sudan's president. President Omar al-Bashir has no preconditions for who can take part in a proposed national dialogue. And the United Nations urges the DRC government to end impunity for rape perpetrators.
Based on the information gathered, it appears that armed groups and state agents were each allegedly responsible for about half of all the cases of sexual violence that we recorded.
Navi Pillay is the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. South Africa's Electoral Commission is receiving special vote applications for the May 7th general election, and African homosexuals seek asylum in the United States. Those stories plus Mark Olman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United States has handed over dozens of vehicles to the African Union military force in the Central African Republic and promised 200 more, as well as more funding for peacekeeping. Nick Long reports for VOA from the Central African Republic capital of Bangui.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, was in Bangui to look at plans for converting the current African Union mission here into a UN peacekeeping mission. The UN Security Council is expected to authorize that move on Thursday. Power attended a ceremony Wednesday at the base of the African Union mission MISCA, where she praised the peacekeepers' sacrifices. More than 20 men of the African mission and 2 men of the French military mission Sangaris have fallen in the line of duty since December. She said the situation has not calmed yet, but told the peacekeepers they have prevented a much greater catastrophe from unfolding.
As terrible as the situation here remains, it would be far worse if not for your efforts to protect civilians, disarm militia, and create areas where families can be safe. I commend you on behalf of President Obama and the United States for your brave service and urge you to persevere.
Ambassador Power said the U.S. has already contributed 37 vehicles to MISCA and is sending another 200, including trucks and armored vehicles. She said U.S. support for the mission, including airlifts and other assistance, totals more than $100 million. The AU mission is still facing the fallout from 2 incidents late last month in which Burundian and Chadian troops were accused of shooting dead a number of civilians in Bangui. Chad has since announced the withdrawal of its 850 troops from MISCA in the face of increasing hostility from many Central Africans. Ambassador Power expressed sympathy for the peacekeepers.
Even the best and bravest efforts can be misunderstood because they fail to achieve instant miracles. Peacekeepers deserve better. You may not be greeted by a parade when you return home, but please know that you have the world's gratitude for your courageous service.
The ambassador also told VOA she has been consulting widely on what the international community can do to help the Muslim communities in the Western CAR, which are still under threat, and whether it should do more to help them relocate to safer areas.
I think part of the challenge is getting a sense of what the individuals in these communities want. And what I think the UN is trying to do is make sure we go on a case-by-case basis and not have a situation where anybody who wishes to leave somehow feels pressed to stay simply for the sake of showing that there's still diversity in the Central African Republic.
She said once the Security Council votes to authorize a UN mission, the military presence should be ramped up to prepare the AU mission for re-hatting as blue helmets from September the 15th, as the UN Secretary General has requested. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
A new United Nations report shows limited progress in fighting sexual violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where too few attackers have been brought to justice. As VOA's Margaret Bashir reports from the United Nations, the cases of sexual violence are the highest in the eastern part of the country, where armed groups continue to threaten civilians.
The statistics are alarming. During the four-year period ending in December 2013, there were more than 3,600 victims of sexual violence. Most were women, but there were also nearly 1,000 children and 81 men. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay told a press conference Wednesday that the victims ranged in age from 2 to 80.
Based on the information gathered, it appears that armed groups and state agents were each allegedly responsible for about half of all the cases of sexual violence that we recorded.
The report found that sexual violence was often committed during armed attacks aimed at gaining control over territories rich in natural resources. Villages were a primary target, and victims were violated in their homes, the fields where they worked, while going to the market or collecting water. The UN Joint Human Rights Office, which conducted the study, said the incidence of sexual violence is higher in the conflict provinces of North and South Kivu and Oriental. Nearly half of all victims were from North Kivu. The study found many obstacles to justice for victims, including a weak national judicial system, which lacks the means to conduct investigations, interview and protect victims and witnesses, as well as the low rate of arrests and convictions. Navi Pillay said improved political will at the highest levels has not sufficiently reduced sexual attacks, and she urged Kinshasa to step up its efforts.
I call on the government to prioritize the fight against impunity for crimes of sexual violence, to promptly complete effective and independent investigations, and to prosecute alleged perpetrators, including those suspected of having command responsibility.
Since 2011, military courts have convicted 187 individuals of sexual crimes, but most were low-ranking soldiers, and very few were senior officers or members of armed groups. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry meets today in Washington with Awan Ryak, the minister in the office of South Sudan's President Salva Kiir. State Department spokesperson Jan Psaki tells VOA State Department correspondent Cass Stearns that today's talks will focus on the urgent need to end the conflict in South Sudan.
Secretary Kerry will emphasize the importance of ending the fighting, implementing the cessation of hostilities agreement, resolving outstanding issues through an inclusive national dialogue, ensuring humanitarian and UN access, and putting a stop to human rights abuses during this meeting. And to answer your other question, no individuals or entities have yet been sanctioned under the new authority signed by President Obama last week. As you know, that provides us the framework in order to make those decisions, and we now have the tools to do so.
So is there currently some review about who might be eligible for those sanctions, or is that simply an authority that you're holding in reserve?
Well, we don't, of course, speculate or comment on that, but obviously we will look to use this broad and flexible authority as appropriate. And as was noted in the announcement last week, this is applicable to those that obstruct the peace and reconciliation process in South Sudan, as well as against those responsible for violence against civilians, human rights abuses, and the obstruction of humanitarian operations. So as is applicable and necessary, those discussions will certainly happen internally.
State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki was speaking with VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns during Wednesday's regular press briefing. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 10th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 minutes past the hour. Sudan's Minister of Information says President Omar al-Bashir and the ruling National Congress Party will welcome the participation of any independent-minded organization in the proposed dialogue between political parties in the country. But Ahmed Bilal says it would be better for the dialogue to take place between and among Sudanese. The National Consensus Forces and the umbrella organization of Sudanese opposition parties had called for an independent body to facilitate the national dialogue. Bilal tells me the government has no prescription of what such a dialogue would lead to, including whether to set up a transitional government.
Actually, we are in the beginning of the dialogue. This is only the beginning, and we want to know about how can we lead this dialogue, and anything can be said and for the grantees, for facilitators from our side. We want it actually a Sudanese dialogue. But we don't actually mind if some independent organization can attend. We have no problem, actually. But I think the better thing is to do this dialogue as Sudanese.
So would this also lead to the formation of a transitional government between your party and the opposition? President Bashir, would he welcome that?
In fact, we have no actually any sort of restrictions of what the dialogue and the debate can lead to. Whatever actually we agree upon, we are going to stick to it. And also we have no any conditions on the others.
For those of us outside of Sudan, we are wondering why now that President Bashir has decided to open the door for reforms, is he trying to look for a legacy, a positive legacy?
This is actually, it's not at all. He kept talking about these reforms a year before. And we start to do it inside the government. Now we started already, we have committees. And we are calling the other Sudanese to join with the government. And we have a debate and a dialogue about the other thing. It is not a sort of legacy. This government is elected. And we agree that we have problems in Sudan. We have instability. We have some of our, citizens, they are rebels, taking weapons. We want actually to solve our problems. This is not actually a search for legacy, but it's a search for stability.
What do you say to other opposition people who are still on the fence and they have not come out to publicly accept President Bashir's offer for dialogue? What do you want to say to them?
There is a problem of trust. Even before, they are talking about this sort of margin of freedom and about movement, about organizations, about this. And now many of them now started to believe. And I think they are all going to join the dialogue.
Ahmed Bilal, Sudan's Minister of Information, he spoke with me from the capital, Khartoum. South Africa's Independent Electoral Commission is receiving applications for a special voting privilege from prospective voters who will be allowed to vote before the scheduled May 7th general election date. Spokesperson Kate Bapila says April 17 will be the closing date for the submission of the special voting application. She says applicants include the SIC, security officers, as well as Electoral Commission officials who will be working on the day of the election. Bapila tells reporter Peter Clotty that the electoral body has been distributing electoral materials to all polling centers across the country in readiness to organize the May vote.
The commission began with applications for special voting. That means that South Africans who won't be able to vote on 7th of May have an opportunity to make applications or make their case to the chief electoral officer. We'll then look at their submission. If in the event that he approves their submission or approves their request to vote before all of us go to the polls, and then that permission will be granted. When you look at the Electoral Act, you've got a portion that is called special voting. Special voting happens on two major categories. So once that permission has been granted, these two major categories of people, the first group being the physically infirm or those who are pregnant and cannot go to the voting station, or election officials will visit their homes on Monday 5 May and Tuesday 6 May between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m.
Tell me about the overall level of preparations in the run-up to the general elections.
We're very ready because we're now going through the, for instance, already doing the dry runs for the result system, rather. The result system is a system where all the results will be uploaded from every voting station in the country. What we do as South Africa when we do, we count our ballots. We count them at the voting station in the presence of party agents. Will then say that I'm comfortable, everybody has read the count together with our officials. Then afterwards, they sign a result slip and that says everyone who has in that voting station agrees with the outcome of the result, so that by the time they get posted through the various processes of verification, of auditing, and finally appearing on the screen at the National Results Operations Center.
How about the printing of the ballot papers that will be used for the election?
The printing of the ballot paper, the process, the companies have been awarded who are going through the colleagues that are dealing with the printing of ballot papers are going through their final markings of ensuring that everything is in order. For instance, on the 24th of March, when the list of candidates, when the candidates will be given certificates from contesting elections, that means every candidate in the country that will be contesting elections from various political parties will be given the certificates on the 24th of April. So once that process has been completed, already the finality of ballot papers shall have been in the bag. They'll be going through the printing and then being dispersed to various voting stations and provinces. So really the printing of ballot paper is at a good pace as well.
Kate Bapila is spokesperson for South Africa's Independent Electoral Commission. She spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Pretoria. Homosexuality is a crime in 38 African countries, and new laws in Nigeria and Uganda have increased potential punishments for engaging in gay sex. So it should be no surprise that some gay and transgender Africans are seeking asylum in the United States. As VOA's Carla Babb reports, for many gay and transgender Ugandans, fleeing their country is a matter of life and death.
I can tell you that it's so bad in Uganda. People just don't know what is happening in Uganda.
Nikki Mwanda recently fled his African homeland. He is transgender.
I'm worried about what is happening to my people, but I'm also scared that when I go back, I don't know what will happen.
African politics professor Stephen Taylor says back in Uganda, what could happen to him is life in prison,
which is just as bad as death penalty, particularly considering the conditions in some prisons.
They staged a big prayer next to my mom's house, praying for me to leave the village, saying that I'm bringing homosexuality on the village. I didn't want to leave my people. But this time round, I became so scared, so I left.
The stakes are much higher.
Gay and transgender asylum seekers from Africa turn to lawyers like Jocelyn Dyer with the group Human Rights First.
We're very concerned that now with these really repressive laws, a bad situation is going to be made even worse.
Death threats and police brutality were among the horrors transgender Ugandan Victor Mukasa faced before gaining asylum in the United States less than a year ago.
I have had people lay their hands, men lay their hands on my genitals, chasing the spirit of homosexuality out of me.
We have not come here to fight.
When you hear the story of people waging war against a particular group of people, this is no different.
The war, as Mukasa calls it, has had its casualties. Ugandan gay rights activist David Kato was murdered in 2011. That's Mukasa at the funeral. He says his mourning quickly turned to fear when anti-gay mobs crashed the service.
We are not going to promote gays.
His friend Monique helped him get a visa and flee with only a suitcase.
I think this was the first day at school.
But they could not get a visa for his adopted daughter, and he had to leave her with a relative.
That's the biggest part of me that I left behind.
Mukasa and Mwanda keep pushing toward a day when they can reunite with loved ones back home.
We're still alive and still passionate about this struggle, and so we shall keep fighting in whichever capacities and wherever we are in the world.
For me, my hope lies in the people of Uganda realizing that we are all Ugandans, and I'm hopeful. But my hope is not much.
For now, Mwanda has months of waiting ahead before he'll know if he can remain safe on American soil. Carla Babb, VOA News, Baltimore, Maryland.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Marco Ume, Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with boxing. Ghana's Joshua Clotty has revived his boxing career when he was crowned the WBA International Light Middleweight Champion. In his first fight in over a year, Clotty scored a 12-round unanimous point victory against Australian Anthony Mandin in Newcastle, New South Wales, Australia. In disability sports, Nigeria clinched their third gold medal at the International Paralympic Committee's Powerlifting World Championship in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. The Nigeria Paralympic Powerlifting Federation Technical Director Samuel Ekeoma told the Lagos media on Wednesday. Ijeoma Ihurobien lifted the bar at 124 kilograms to claim victory in the women's 73 kilogram division, Ekoma revealed. Earlier in the contest, Nigerian 2012 Paralympic Games gold medalist Yakubu Adesokan and the 2013 Asian Open champion gold medalist Esther Oyema each improved their world records by 3 kilograms in their respective events. Adesokan won the men's 46-kilogram division with a lift of 181 kilograms, while Oyema lifted 125 kilograms to prevail in the women's 55-kilogram division. Nigerian Anthony Ulonam bagged a bronze medal when he lifted 183 kilograms in the men's 59-kilogram division. The week-long contest ends tomorrow, Friday. Turning to table tennis, hosts Egypt powered their way to the finals of the boys and girls team event at the ITTF Africa Junior Table Tennis Championships in Cairo, Egypt on Wednesday. In the boys' contest, Egypt dismissed Angola 3-0 while Tunisia eliminated Congo-Brazzaville in a similar fashion. The Congolese later edged Angola 3-2 to claim the bronze medal. In the girls' competition, Egypt outclassed Tunisia 3-0 as Nigeria pipped Algeria 3-2. Tunisia went on to outplay Algeria 3-1 to claim the bronze medal. Today, Thursday, Egypt played Tunisia in the boys' finals, while Nigeria challenged Egypt in the girls' final. With the team competition ending today, Thursday, the singles contest takes center stage for the next 2 days. In football, Nigeria's Flying Eagles squeezed a 2-2 draw against their Moroccan peers, who hosted them in Rabat on Wednesday night. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Our listener mail for this Thursday morning comes from Joseph Babatunde Odonta of Osogbo in Osun State, Nigeria. He says, "Dear Mr. Batty, I commend you for your report earlier this week on the Ebola outbreak in Liberia and a few West African nations. However, I disagree with your interviewee's opinion that President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf should cut short her European tour because of the outbreak to show her love or concern for the people. I want to stress here that leadership role is a huge responsibility and our African leaders must be respected and supported." Thank you, Joseph Babatunde Odonte of Osogbo in Osun State, Nigeria, for your comment. And please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United Nations Security Council is set to authorize a new expanded peacekeeping force for the Central African Republic. The Council is expected to adopt a resolution today, Thursday, calling for a force of 10,000 soldiers and 1,800 police to help restore order in the troubled country. According to a draft resolution seen by VOA, the UN force will be operational by September 15th, when it will take over from the existing African force in the Central African Republic. 6,000 African troops and 2,000 French troops have been unable to contain sectarian violence that has killed thousands of people. That's it for this Thursday, April 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Button, Washington, saying have a lovely day, Africa.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.